Hey, you, Tom, it's Bob from the office down the hall. It's good to see you, buddy. How have you been? Things have been okay for me, except that I'm a zombie now. I really wish you'd let us in.
Hello there. Welcome to the Apologetics Canada podcast. This is Steve Kim, your host. I have here with me Andy Steiger, as usual.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
And we have a very special guest here. Chris Battle has joined us on staff. Say hello, Chris.
Hello.
There we go. So,
in fact, this is Chris's very first podcast.
Yes, we were talking about
the fact that this is my first podcast.
Yeah, let's just put it that way.
Dude, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm glad to be able to take part in such a epic podcast.
How does it feel doing your very first podcast?
Well, actually, the magic's kind of taken away. I would picture you guys sitting in, you know, surrounded by books and just auras about you as you wax philosophical. Yeah, exactly. But it's not quite like that, but yet is still great.
Yeah, if anybody's curious, as we wax eloquently, we are surrounded in a room in a church. We're actually in a children's room that's full of giant stuffy chairs that you can jump on. What are those? Those are beanbag chairs. Are. And it's pretty humble. But we're here and glad to be here.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
So, Andy, tell us a little bit about how you guys know each other.
Yeah, that's a great place to start. For those of you who don't know Chris Battle, I'll let Chris introduce himself. And just to encourage everyone, he's going to be with us now at Apologetics Canada and on the podcast, which will be exciting. We're glad to have him. But yeah, Chris, why don't you just tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got here?
I guess I'll just start with how I met Andy, because that would probably be the easiest. Mm-hmm. Andy at Emmanuel Fellowship Baptist Church about 7 years ago, 7.5 years ago. After he had come back from a trip from India, he was preaching, and I was a new Christian, had been in the church for a couple of months, and was sitting and listening to him, and I heard his story about going to Calcutta and the great things he shared there, and it got me jazzed to want to do missions, and so I ended up contacting Andy, and sort of the rest, as far as that went, was history. We developed a relationship. Friendship and mentor-mentee relationship, and that has carried on through the years. And
in fact, if people want to read more about it, my new book, Thinking, Answering Life's Five Biggest Questions.
Shameless plug.
There we go.
Chapter 6, Chris and I talk about our relationship, and if you want to know more about it, that'd be a great spot to find out about it.
You married?
Yes, I sure am. I got a lovely wife, Sarah. We've been married just about 3 years. We met in Poland in 2010 on a mission trip. Yes, on a mission trip. So that was good. I don't know if that's if I should be plugging dating on mission trips. Is that taboo? Hey, or?
Dude, absolutely, whatever it takes.
But just recently were living in Quebec City. She's Quebecoise. And we were living there for just under 3 years. And then we've just recently returned to the Fraser Valley, which has been sort of a surrogate home for me. I'm a Vancouver Island boy by nature, but man, I should say now. But
Oh, by the way, Sarah is not only is she French, but she's also a redhead. So please don't tick her off.
There we go. Seriously, it's just bad.
But Chris is started up with Apologetics Canada here, and he's in the midst of fundraising to be a part of this team. How's that going?
It's going excellent. God's just been working hard through a bunch of generous people. We got a lot of people who are praying for us on a regular basis and supporting us through encouragement as well as through finances. Right now, we're at about 40% of I'm about 40% of my needed monthly goal. So I'm encouraged to see how everything's going with that.
That is fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I just encourage you, if you want to participate with Apologetics Canada, we would love for you to do that. There's two ways right now that you can financially partner with us. Right now, we need to raise about $30,000 to continue doing Apologetics Canada. And so you could actually email Steve Kim, or you could email info@apologeticscanada.com to learn more about how you can partner with us. But you can also partner with Chris Battle as well. As he was saying, he's about 40% of his funds. Mm-hmm. And we're praying with him and seeking to work with him so he could raise the rest of that so that we can continue to do ministry. And I think it's just important for people to know, like, we just sent out a letter just talking about how the reach of Apologetics Canada continues to grow. And as our reach across Canada continues to grow, our funds have increased, the expenses. Yeah, our expenses have increased, our need for funds have increased. And so we're just asking people that appreciate this ministry and have been ministered by it, if you'd help us, partner with us. The cool thing about us as an organization and funding is that we working with Northview Community Church. They provide a place for us, office space for us. They provide a lot of things for us so that the money that, and they do our finances and everything for free for us. So the money that's given to Apologetics Canada goes directly to Apologetics Canada mm-hmm. and to the ministry that we're doing.
And when Andy says that Northview does finances for us, we mean accounting. Northview doesn't actually directly fund our ministry. And I think there is some misunderstanding out there that because we are a ministry of Northview, that Northview funds all of our ministry activities. That's not true, actually. Yeah, if you feel particularly generous, please give us a shout at info@apologeticscanada.com and we'll hook you up.
On that note, as well, as you're listening to the podcast, we recently got some people who've sent in some questions on stuff that we've said on previous podcasts, and that's awesome. If you would like to ask a question of us, send an email to, I think the best one would be to send an email to you, Steve.
Yep, steve@apologeticscanada.com.
And we'll make sure to address that question. One of the questions that was asked recently was, I made a comment, mm-hmm. The atheist must live as though their worldview is not true, whereas the Christian lives as though their worldview is true. And the listener was just asking for a little bit more clarification on that point. So how would you guys clarify that?
I would say that if atheistic naturalism is true, then determinism is also true. The idea that everything has been determined and we have no free will and everything is just at the most basic level, just physics and chemistry. If that's true, we have no free will. If we don't have any free will, we have no moral responsibility. Our consciousness is just an illusion. But all of these things we take to be true, that real, that we do have consciousness, that we do have free will, that we do have moral responsibility. The only thing that we really have to do to be convinced of moral reality is to be on the receiving end of some evil act, right? So all that is to say that if atheistic naturalism is true, we have to deny consciousness, free will, so on and so forth, moral responsibility, which we really can't. I don't think you can actually live like that. Whereas on the Christian worldview, these things can be all accounted for, and it makes perfect sense. So the Christian can live as though these things are real.
And more than that, if we think that there are moral obligations, mm-hmm. then you must live as though these
exactly.
things are true.
Yeah.
And in fact, we'll hold you accountable as a, mm-hmm. as a society mm-hmm. for your moral obligations, right? I mean, I could think of all kinds of scenarios that you could be put into, and to turn a blind eye, you know, you would be held legally accountable. You would be held morally accountable mm-hmm. to turn your back on a person in, you know, in need in specific ways. Do you know?
Yeah.
You understand what I'm saying? I could think of examples, but one of the quotes that always sticks in my mind is a famous atheistic existentialist by the name of Albert Camus, and he said, "In the darkest depths of my nihilism, I have sought for the means to transcend nihilism." And what he's saying there is this idea of nihilism or nihilism is a worldview in which there's no meaning, purpose, or value. And ultimately what he's saying is, although he holds to that worldview because of his atheism, because of his beliefs, he still is trying to figure out a way to get out of the implications of his beliefs, as Steve has just shared. So although that's the worldview that they academically believe, and this is actually how a professor at Duke University I once heard put it in a lecture. Mm-hmm. He said, although this is what I academically believe, specifically in that context, determinism, which was what he was talking about. He says, although I academically believe this is true, I don't live as though this is true.
It's nice when people of that persuasion or that worldview are able to come across at least honest about it and say, this is it, instead of trying to somehow argue for objective morality from some other sort of source. They admit that it's all subjective and it's a personal choice. I remember at Nancy Piercy at this past Politics Canada conference in March, telling or giving illustrations of that, of people she's engaged with that have even tried to come across as having moral lives apart from this sort of deterministic worldview that they hold, but then being taken aback when being called down to the carpet on it and called out for living opposed to their worldview.
Right. So, you know, assuming one worldview in the lab coat, and when the lab coat comes off, right, you assume a different worldview, right? If determinism is true, then there's really no value, purpose, anything of that sort. But, I mean, anybody with a family can attest to this. Your family matters. Your family is actually important. They actually have inherent value, not just for the joy that they bring you, but they are actually, as human beings, in themselves, they're valuable.
This leads really well into the discussion that we want to talk about today, and that is our fourth part in the zombie culture. What would that be, Steve? I'm sure you know what that would be. If it's not a trilogy, it's a
quadrilogy or something.
Quadrilogy.
Well, that's not a word, it is now.
Well, that's what we're looking at today. We've been working through this series. It's a four-part series on zombie culture. And specifically, I defined, again, zombie culture as any worldview that leads to the dehumanization of people. And basically, I've made the argument that this happens in four different ways that we see, particularly in the book of Genesis, from books chapters 1 to 3. And the idea is just simply this, that four things were created, and if you remove God from any of these four things, it leads to the dehumanization of people. Mm-hmm. And so the first three were created by God. The last one was created by people. But yet God's still necessary for all four. So just as a reminder, we started out with the fact that God created the universe and that God is necessary as the creator of the universe in order for us to be understood as people, as anything more than just a cosmic explosion of atoms on a trajectory in the universe waiting for the heat death of the universe, the laws of thermodynamics to take effect.
And if you're not familiar with that bit of thermodynamics, it basically says that the energy that we have that is usable is running out. So we're actually on a tank of gas, so to speak, and the gasoline is running out, and we'll reach a point where there is no more energy that we can use, and it will basically be in a sort of a cosmic junkyard, so to speak. And that's what's referred to as the heat death of the universe.
Exactly. That's why they call it the heat death. To give an illustration of this, it'd be like putting a cup of boiling water or a hot tea, you know, a cup of hot tea on your countertop. What will that cup of hot tea do? Well, it will slowly cool down, right, until it matches the temperature of the room. Well, in this case, the universe is hot, if you will, from its creation, and it will cool down until there's no more heat left. Mm-hmm. So that's the first one. The second one is that God created life, and that if we remove God from the creation of human life in particular, that again, what we have is reductionism. And well, we won't get into that, but you can go back and listen to this. And then last time we spoke on this, we talked about the creation of relationship, and how God is necessary for us to understand ourselves in relationship with one another, with God, and that when we remove that, we take ourselves, it actually is a part of who we are as people, and that, again, leads to dehumanization. The fourth one now that we want to look at is the creation of evil. Now, as I was saying, The first three God created. This last one God did not create. However, and this is so key to understand that God is necessary in order for us to, intelligently or even in any way substantiate the idea of evil. Now, this one I find to be the one that surprises people the most, that confuses people the most, and I see it the one in which in our culture today is being challenged the most. Mm-hmm. Now, just to give you a brief illustration of how I've seen this play out, a good friend of mine had his brother. His brother went to Africa on a short-term missions trip. My friend goes to the airport to pick up his brother. He had just was on the short-term missions trip in Africa. And as he picks him up at the airport, his brother gives him a hug and tells him that he has lost his faith. Now, I mean, my friend was really confused, right? Because if anything, he's expecting to hear about how excited, right, his brother is from this missions trip, and here he's lost his faith. And ultimately, he goes on to tell him that of all the suffering and evil that he saw in Africa, he determined that surely God doesn't exist. And really, this is what I want to get at today is how nonsensical that is, and how that doesn't make sense, and how often people will say things like that without really giving it thought. What do they mean when they say that? So to get into this discussion, I think it'd be best just to crack open our Bibles and take a look at Genesis chapter 3, verses 1 to 7. In Genesis, this is what we read. And there's two things in particular that I'm going to highlight for you in this passage. So we read this. Now the serpent was more crafty than any other beast in the field that the Lord God had made. Now this idea of serpent here, Satan isn't directly being referred to, but it is being implied. And so most people would say that this is most likely referring to Satan.
Especially when you consider things like Revelation 12 with the mm-hmm. great serpent.
That imagery.
Yeah, the imagery.
And that imagery, absolutely. Now, now we could just take a pause right there for a moment, and that tells us something already then. Mm-hmm. It tells us that really in evil has already entered into right. the scene.
It's already there.
Yeah. It's already there. We already have, and in fact, this is the Hebrew name for Satan, or when referring to Satan as the adversary or opposer.
Or accuser. Yeah.
So we're talking about somebody now that is in opposition to God, and that actually exists before humans even come on the scene.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
And so that's important to understand. It means then simply that the first ones to fall were angels. Now, I have to pause there for a moment, though, because I got to tell you, when I talk about this with Christians, I am continually amazed at how quick Christians are to adopt a very Eastern understanding of right. evil. And this yin-yang, am I saying that right, Steve?
Yeah, yin-yang, yeah.
Yeah, that this dueling forces, right? Mm-hmm. And that you've got good and evil and they're fighting each other and we're hoping and, you know, Lord willing, the good's going to win. Mm-hmm. And ultimately what you find is that this is not a biblical understanding of right. good and evil at all. The biblical understanding is there's good. Period.
Period. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Evil has not always existed. Right. And in fact, it came into being. And I have to remind people a lot of times that Satan is not the embodiment of evil. That Satan is not evil. Satan does evil. And that's an important distinction. Because all you have to do is remind people of what was Satan before he was Satan. Well, he was Lucifer, right? He was an angel. You know, he hasn't always been bad. Mm-hmm. And so it's helpful for them, for people to understand that evil then came into being. And as we get into this discussion today, you're going to see how important that is to appreciate and to understand. So now I'm going to continue on here. So now the serpent was more crafty than any other beast of the field that the Lord God had made. And he said to the woman, did God actually say you shall not eat of any tree in the garden? Now notice what's already happened there. And this is one of the things that there's two main ideas that I want you to see out of here. And the first one is that the first thing that happens is this serpent begins to question God. Did God actually say, you shall not eat of any tree in the garden? And the woman said to the serpent, we may eat of the fruit of the trees in the garden, but God said, you shall not eat of the fruit of the tree that is in the midst of the garden, neither shall you touch it, lest you die. Let's just pause there for a moment. Mm-hmm. Now, what do we got happening here? Now, God's told Adam and Eve that you're not supposed to eat of this tree that's in the garden. Mm-hmm. But what's happening now is Eve is now adding to what God said. And now she's saying, you're not even supposed to touch it. So she's already beginning. And by the way, I think that this is actually quite interesting how we do this. And you'll see this with the Hebrews throughout the Old Testament, mm-hmm. adding to God's commands. And we do this as well. And then now what we're going to see is this twisting of what God said. But the serpent said to the woman, you will not surely die. Again, now questioning God. For God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened and you will be like God, knowing good and evil. So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food and that it was delightful to the eyes and that the tree was to be desired to make one wise, she took of its fruit and ate. And she also gave some to her husband who was with her and he ate. And this is important to understand too. A lot of people get this idea that there's Eve there. And there's a serpent, and they're having this interaction. And then she somehow goes over and finds Adam, right, who's probably talking with God or praying.
He's, like, standing sheepishly behind her.
Exactly. I think a lot of people think, oh, he's far away doing something noble.
Yeah.
No, he's standing beside her, you know, sheepishly, exactly, as this is all playing out. Now we're in verse 7. Then the eyes of both of them were opened, and they knew that they were naked. And they sewed fig leaves together and made themselves loincloths. Now this is significant too as this ends, because we know that before this that they were naked and that there was no shame. Mm-hmm. And now here they are and they realize that they're naked, and now shame has entered into the picture. It's always reminds me of my kids. Even last night we gave our boys a bath, and before their bath they were both buck naked running around the house like two wild animals. But there's something about children, right, that helps us to appreciate this innocence. And as they get older, you begin to see how this innocence is lost. I'm already seeing it with my son, Tristan, mm-hmm. how he, when we will go swimming, right now he's super conscious and he will wear a t-shirt. He doesn't like to have his shirt off in front of people.
Huh.
But of course, with mom and dad, he could be buck naked running around the house. Mm-hmm. No problem. But there's this idea that things were good, mm-hmm. and that we were in a good and a right relationship with God and each other, and there wasn't any shame.
No secrets.
Yeah, no. Exactly. Yeah. No secrets. We didn't need to keep anything from one another. And now all of a sudden, these things have crept in. And I think, it was interesting, talking about this passage once with my son. My son's 7, and he said to me, you know, Dad, that Adam and Eve ate an apple. You know, they ate the apple that they weren't supposed to eat. And I said, yeah, I know. And he was basically asking me, like, you know, what was up with this apple? And I think a lot of people kind of think that. You know what?
The magic fruit.
Exactly, right? There must have been some sort of magic in this fruit.
Yeah.
And that by eating that magic fruit, that's what caused the problem.
And why is it always an apple? Why couldn't it be something, I don't know, more exotic, like a coconut?
or I always think like a pomegranate or something like that.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah. Some sort of mango.
But I guess you don't really like bite into a pomegranate. But so the idea there is not that there was something magical about this fruit, but the key being that it was the act. It was that God said, here's this tree, don't eat of it. And you have Adam and Eve that begin to question God with the help of the serpent and begin to twist God's words, begin to twist God's truth, and ultimately find themselves disobeying God, and that they bite into this apple. And ultimately what we begin to see then is that the universe was good, that God created a good world, and that we were in a good and right relationship with God, but through disobedience. through the breaking of relationship with God, that we have introduced evil into the world. And then this really raises this question then of what do we mean when we're talking about evil? Like, what exactly took place there that we would call it evil? And what do we even mean by that word?
Well, it seems to me that as you set it up, it's the existence of good was, it was sort of, I don't know, I want to use the word a priori, but it was foundational to the universe coming out of God's character. So with the introduction of disobedience into that, it took the good, which was walking with God, and then twisting it. And turning it into something that was contrary to God, contrary to his desires and his relationship then with Adam and Eve, and therefore became what we have just come to know as evil.
Right.
It set a line of action in motion that was contrary to the will of God, contrary to what he originally thought for his people.
Yeah, I like how you're setting that up too, because like Andy was saying earlier, a lot of Christians bought into this idea of duality, right? Which comes from things like, I don't know, Taoism and things like that. You have good, you have evil, they're both equal. But what you're saying is that you have the good, and then the evil is basically the corruption of it, right? And the illustration that we often like to use is that of the counterfeit currency. So you have your currency and your counterfeit currency. You can have the real currency without the counterfeit, but you can't have it the other way around, right?
How would you know?
Right. Yeah. If you don't have the original, there's nothing to corrupt. And that's exactly what it is. That counterfeit currency is the corruption of the real currency. And so that is to say, evil is not necessary, like in the Eastern religions, according to the monotheistic worldview.
To try to balance things out or something like that.
Yeah, it's not like that at all. It's not about balance or harmony. But evil, according to this Judeo-Christian worldview, and I would say Islam as well, depending on your view of God there. But the evil is a contingent reality, that it doesn't have to be there. Evil itself is contingent. It's the corruption of the standard that God's nature sets out for
and
us.
And that's a good word to use, because we're talking about, with the illustration of currency and counterfeit currency. Mm-hmm. So when we're talking about currency, we're talking about a standard, talking about the way currency should be. Mm-hmm. And so when we're talking about this world, then we're talking about this idea that there's a standard, there's a way that things should be. And so when we talk about good and evil, we're talking about this idea of morality. Mm-hmm. And by that, we always mean relationship. Mm-hmm. We're talking about, like, because I mean, think about this one for a second. Think about, can you have good and evil outside of relationship? Now, like, in many ways, I don't even know what that would look like, where, you know, could you do evil if you were just by yourself? Could you do good if you were just by yourself?
Yeah, that's an interesting, that's almost like the Platonic problem, right? Because Plato thought that there were such things as justice, goodness, and charity, and things like that, that are kind of abstract objects that exist apart from us. But William Lane Craig points out, like, he doesn't even know what it means for something to be good apart from a person, right? Apart from personhood, how do you make sense of what does it mean to be just? If you think of it in a kind of a, if you will, personless universe, what does that mean?
Well, and then ultimately, like, if you're like me, you're always thinking counterexamples. Okay, what would be a counterexample to this? And so ultimately then a lot of people are going to think, yeah, but I can still think of those existing. And I think the only reason you could still think of those things existing, whether or not they be an abstract object or anything else, mm-hmm. is because we would say, and I think Dr. Craig would agree, well, these things exist because God exists. Mm-hmm. And these things exist in the mind of God. But when we're talking about morality, we're talking about this idea of a standard for the way that relationships should be.
Right.
Is ultimately what we mean by that standard of relationship. It's the way that the world ought to be.
Right.
And that's why evil becomes such a unique thing, right? Because here we're saying, you know, lately in the news, let's just take something in the news right now. Right now, Nepal has had its second earthquake, mm-hmm. right? And a bunch of people died. And people will say, this is tragic, this is terrible, right? And we'll be saying things like, you know, the world just shouldn't be like this. And that raises questions then. And it raises the question of, well, how should the world be? Mm-hmm. Or when we see in the news right now that a blogger in Bangladesh was hacked to death mm-hmm. for speaking out against Islam. And people say, this is terrible. A lot of people, a lot of the atheist community is saying, this is terrible. This is unjust. It shouldn't be this way. Mm-hmm. Again, well, it raises the question, well, how ought the world be? Yeah. Right? How should we be in relationship with each other mm-hmm. and with nature?
Right.
And so what you begin to see is that there's two understandings of morality. Mm-hmm. There is natural evil and there is moral evil. Steve, you just want to distinguish those two?
Yeah. I'll start with moral evil. Moral evil is pretty simply, that's what we're most familiar with, right? Things that people do to each other. So murder, rape, child molestation, theft, all these things are considered moral evil, and that's what people do. Natural evil is what we see in, well, nature, right? How the world plays out. Earthquakes, tsunamis, cancer, all kinds of other diseases and conditions. And these things, if you notice, aren't caused by people. I mean, there might be some connection to moral evil, but even without moral evil, like, these things would exist. It's just how the nature works. But when it happens to people, that's when we say, oh, this is natural evil.
Now, isn't it interesting? I was just thinking about this, that in many ways, natural evil is moral evil. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, who's the one that we're holding morally accountable for the natural evil? Mm-hmm. And we would say, well, it's God. Because if God's in control of earthquakes and tsunamis and tornadoes,
right,
then he could do something to stop that from taking place.
Or so it's claimed, yeah.
Yeah, or so yeah. It's claimed.
So it's his fault.
Right. So we wouldn't blame the earth for it. We wouldn't blame the sky or...
Yeah,
you know, for that tragedy.
But we have to blame a person.
That's right. Now we're back to a person. Mm-hmm. But we need to blame a person so we would hold God mm-hmm. accountable. Right. And so I wanted to help people to see that. Look, notice how we've come back to blaming a person. You have to. Because morality, again, outside of personhood, is nonsense. Mm-hmm. Now that raises a couple issues that we've got to talk about. The first one, though, that I want to just mention is notice how we are now flirting with dehumanization. Because ultimately, if you hold to a worldview in which God does not exist, well, then it is the earth that's responsible for an earthquake. Mm-hmm. It is the sky or tornado that's, you know, responsible for those deaths. Mm-hmm. And if that's the case, then it raises, well, in what sense can the earth be held accountable for an earthquake? Mm-hmm. You know, isn't the earth just dirt? And isn't dirt just ultimately particles? You know, how in what way should they be held accountable? They're just mm-hmm. they're just behaving according to right. their properties.
You're imposing moral duty on the earth, which doesn't make sense because duty is something you owe. And I think I've mentioned this before, but you don't owe things to things. You owe things to people. So for example, I don't owe anything to my computer. I don't owe anything to the water bottle. But if I were to, say, borrow a book from you, Chris, I now owe you something. I owe it to you to return the book. Now I have this duty, right? But how do you make sense of that between a person and an inanimate object like a water bottle? I don't owe anything to the water bottle. The water bottle doesn't owe anything to me. So if you're going to blame the earth, you either have to personify nature.
Capital N, yep, nature, yeah, capital which N. You hear a lot these days.
Yeah.
Well, cosmos is all there was, all, yeah.
All yeah. there will be, mm-hmm. yeah. Yeah, who was that?
Carl Sagan.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, universe was all there was, will be.
All there is.
And oh, yeah, all there is. Was
which
or
is,
will
which
be.
Which is funny, right? Because that's the kind of language that Christians use to describe God, the Alpha and Omega, right?
Oh, yeah.
One who was and is and always will be.
Yeah.
I thought that's kind of interesting how you always end up coming back to some kind of a person, even if it means personifying something that's inanimate.
Exactly.
So now look what happens when we when we move this one step further now we're doing this with nature, right? We're saying, okay, well, how can I hold the earth accountable for an earthquake? Well, if I remove God from the picture, but now the question is being raised of a human being. Well, Steve, you know, how can I hold you accountable for what you do? Or what about those people that hacked this blogger in Bangladesh? Mm-hmm. And in what sense can those people be held accountable for their actions if they're just like the earth? Mm-hmm. They're just a bunch of particles.
Exactly. It comes back full circle to the problem of the scientific naturalist who has no free will under their worldview.
Right.
How can they hold other people accountable? So as you say, it automatically strips them of personhood.
That's right. Determinism. Now, notice that these are all interconnected, what we've been talking mm-hmm. about in this series. Ultimately just says that when the Big Bang exploded the universe into being, that our particles were sent in on a trajectory that was determined by that explosion, and I can do none other than move in the direction of this trajectory, of this explosion. And so whatever I might do in this life is ultimately determined from my trajectory or determined from my DNA mm-hmm. and that my makeup, my surroundings, and ultimately I could have done no other. Now, that raises a problem then. I mean, in what sense can we hold anyone accountable for their actions? And again, this gets back to that question that the listener was asking, you know, about why is it that the atheist can't live as though their worldview is true? Well, I mean, who wants to live as though that's true? You steal from me or you kill my mm-hmm. child. I'm not going to live as though that was just particles moving on a trajectory.
You dancing to your DNA.
Yeah, or that you're dancing to your DNA, right? I want justice.
Yeah.
I'm going to say that was wrong. I'm going to say that was evil because I know intuitively that there's a way that things should be mm-hmm. and you have behaved in a way opposite of the way things should be.
And that's really key too, because often when we talk about these things, we do talk about liking and not liking a certain action. And a lot of people think that's what this argument is about, that because we don't like a certain act that is done to us, and therefore it's evil, we consider it evil. That's not what we're saying at all. We're saying we can intuit, right? We can see, we're directly aware of the moral reality that imposes itself on us. So it has nothing to do with our own preferences, but it's just that when an evil act is done to us, we see it for what it is, that it is evil. We didn't just call it evil. There is something evil there that we just recognize, just as we recognize 2 + 2 = 4. In the same way, we're directly aware of that evil that has been done to us.
We don't have to rationalize it. We don't have to to think it through. We just automatically get it.
Right. Just as, you know, when I see you, Chris, I just see you, right? I am directly aware of your presence.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have to use any inference, right? I don't have to go, okay, you know, major premise, minor premise, and therefore Chris is in front of me. I don't do that. I just see you, you're there. I'm directly aware of you.
That's why then when we have these quotes by guys like Richard Dawkins, who wrote in his book, River Out of Eden, the universe we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, and no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. We understand intuitively he's wrong. That's absolutely not the case. Now, if his worldview's correct, then he's right.
And you know, the funny thing is, he doesn't live that out himself either.
No, I don't even think you can
not
live
even,
it out.
Yeah, not even close, right? Because have you read The God Delusion? I mean, have you seen his diatribe against religion?
Yeah.
What he's saying is, this is evil, basically, right? That it is to raise a child, you know, teaching them like doctrines and things like that, that's just brainwashing. And that
it's akin
wrong.
To child abuse. Yeah,
exactly. That's what he calls it. Right?
Yeah. He even tweeted recently that, and I think we talked about this on an earlier one, that if you found out that you were having a kid with Down syndrome, that you're morally obligated to abort that child.
Right.
And I want to know where all of a sudden did you get this ought from?
Yeah. Especially if you think in terms of the
blind, pitiless
indifference.
Exactly.
Where did, how did he get that privileged position of making moral pronouncements when he himself says that there's, we're only dancing to our DNA?
Yeah.
It's all just trajectory. There's no,
it's incoherent.
My favorite is why he could even be upset with those people who believe in God.
Right.
Well, isn't my belief in God just a part of my trajectory? Mm-hmm. Isn't it just part of where this Big Bang happens to have led me, and you just happen to be an atheist? Mm-hmm. How could one be any better than the other? Mm-hmm. Now, here's another quote from Alex Rosenberg. And I find I like to pick on Rosenberg a little bit.
He's vociferous, particularly.
Yeah, yeah, he helps us show how atheists can speak out of both sides of their mouth. Mm-hmm. Rosenberg recently wrote this in his book, The Atheist Guide to Reality.
Yeah,
there we go. Right.
Yeah. He wrote this. What is the purpose of the universe? There is none. What is the meaning of life? Ditto. Is there free will? Not a chance. What is the difference between right and wrong, good and bad? There is no moral difference between them. Why should I be moral? Because it makes you feel better than being immoral. Is abortion, euthanasia, suicide, pain, taxes, foreign aid, or anything else you don't like forbidden, permissible, or sometimes obligatory? Anything goes, he says. Now, what I find fascinating about what he says there is that, again, here you have somebody that doesn't live as though this is true. Mm-hmm. And so people who would like to see how he speaks out of both sides of his mouth, take a look at a YouTube video in which he is debating Dr. William Lane Craig on the existence of God. And when you watch this video, just take a look at minute mark 57 and then minute mark 122, an hour and 22 minutes. Mm-hmm. And what you'll see is Dr. Rosenberg talking about how his family, people in his family were in the Holocaust and they were
killed.
They were killed.
It's really horrific. Yeah.
Yeah. And how, and it was horrific, and how he mm-hmm. is disgusted mm-hmm. by what took place in World War II. And so you're like, well, what are you talking about? You seem to think that there is no free will and that there is no moral difference from right and wrong. Mm-hmm. Well, what are you so upset about, Dr. Rosenberg?
And if he is upset about it, I mean, he can't really impose that on somebody else, right? Like, he can't go on to say, okay, Dr. Craig, now you have to actually make sense of this for me on your worldview. Because really, if his worldview is true, then all it is just chemical reaction inside of him that works in a certain way that could have worked in a different way.
Yeah, these are bags of chemicals. And mm-hmm. the Nazis were just bags of chemicals mm-hmm. that happened to enjoy destroying other bags of chemicals.
And it removes any sort of like moral dimension to his claim that, you know, like this is disgusting, right? If it is, in fact, a moral claim, which sounds like it is to me.
Yeah, well, if anybody at that point has the burden of proof, the onus is on him to explain the problem of good, because he seems right. He seems to be struggling with that or keep
and then that's exactly
going after it.
Well, it's funny about that is that's exactly what he does in the debate. He then says, I think it was at the second hour and 22 marker, that he then looks at Dr. Craig and says, Dr. Craig, if you can explain to me why God would allow evil, then he says, I'll become a Christian today. And at that moment, my mind exploded.
Yeah.
Like, and I remember just thinking, you've got to be kidding me. Really? I mean, isn't he really showing his cards at this point?
I think he really did.
Yeah.
In fact, we asked Dr. Craig about it when he came to our conference a couple of years ago, right? I asked what was going through your mind when Dr. Rosenberg said that. He said that he was really surprised because he wasn't asking for any sort of other kinds of arguments. Like, he was asking for the solution to the logical problem of evil. Not the evidential one, not the emotional problem, evil, logical problem, which virtually all philosophers agree today has been resolved.
Yeah, it's solved.
Yeah.
Particularly by Plantinga.
Right, Alvin Plantinga. And so really what I was actually kind of surprised that he went for the logical version of it. It's almost like he's not really aware of that dialogue and where it's at today.
Yeah, that and Dr. Craig was talking about how And I agree with him just from listening to it, mm-hmm. that he was actually quite sincere. Mm-hmm. That it seemed to me that he was being sincere. Like, he was, it wasn't, It wasn't like he didn't understand what he was saying. He understood what he was saying. And that's why my mind exploded, is because I'm thinking, you just wrote a book on atheism. And you just wrote things like I just read for you. And it's like, do you really, apparently you don't really think that what you wrote is true. And really, and this is something that I've really seen a lot as I've talked with people on this question. It seems to me that the real problem that you have is with God. I find that most atheists that I speak with, their arguments against God are actually more arguments about why they don't like God and less arguments about why God doesn't exist.
It's an emotional.
Yeah. Especially when it comes to the issue of evil, right? Because let's just say the problem of evil is unresolvable, right? That, you know, God, for whatever the... But that doesn't mean God doesn't exist, right? It could be that God is just an evil God, you know, a maniacal, some maniacal deity that just likes to inflict pain on the creatures that he's created. It doesn't, even the problem of evil doesn't necessarily lead to atheism. It leads to some other form of theism. And so, insofar as that, our atheist friends are using the problem of evil to draw any sort of atheistic conclusions, they can't. I don't think they can.
What I find interesting is that when culture looks back at what the Nazis did, and of course, Rosenberg's picking up on this, what they did was horrific. Well, what did we do as a culture? Did we let them get away with what they did? No, we wanted to hold them accountable for what they did, for systematically murdering Jews, gypsies, homosexuals, and the handicapped. Yeah, and then and others as well. And but the question was, is how are we going to do it? Well, we couldn't hold them accountable to German law because the problem was
legal.
It was legal.
Yeah.
They're not dumb. They passed laws so that all of the murdering that they were doing was in fact legal in Germany. And in fact, it was in Germany that these things were taking place. Mm-hmm. So because some people were like, well, when these were taking place, ultimately these are famously referred to as the Nuremberg trials. The idea was, well, maybe we hold them a trial according to the British laws or American laws. But the problem was it didn't happen in America. It didn't happen in the UK. It happened in Germany. So how are we going to hold them accountable? Now, ultimately, what happened was we held them accountable by saying, well, although you didn't break German law, and although this didn't happen in any other country, you broke a greater law. We would call this a supra-positive, a supreme law, that you broke a law above the law. Now, ultimately, they didn't want to define what they meant by that law above the law.
Smart of them not to.
Because ultimately what they understood by it is that there is this law, as Martin Luther King referred to, Martin Luther King Jr. referred to when he wrote a letter from the Birmingham jail. He said this, and I think this is what we know, that the Nuremberg trial, that was the law that they were held to. And he says this, says, a just law is a man-made code that squares with the moral law or law of God. An unjust law is a code that is out of harmony with the moral law. To put it in terms of St. Thomas Aquinas, an unjust law is a human law not rooted in eternal law and natural law. What we all understand is that there is this law that we are all held accountable to. And it doesn't matter what you personally say is right or wrong. It doesn't matter what a nation says is what's right and wrong. We know that there is a law that we're all accountable to, that there's a standard by which we're all accountable to that transcends us individually and transcends us corporately, that we all are held to. And that ultimately that this law would be God's law. And that when we say then that God is the standard for right relationship, this is where Christianity to me becomes so critical, is that we're saying that when we say that God is good, and with angels or people, how we have corrupted God's goodness and have brought evil into existence, that what we've done is we have corrupted God's standard. Now, what do we mean then when we're talking about God's standard of right relationship? What we mean in Christianity, and again, like I was saying, this is why Christianity is so important to me, is that Christianity holds to a relational God, a triune God, a Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. That when we say that God is good, or when we say that God is love in Christianity, mm-hmm. we can say that in that God lives in right relationship within himself. He is the standard of right relationship, that the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit are that standard. Mm-hmm. And that when we say that God is love, that we're saying that in the Trinity, that God embodies that love, that he is love because he lives in right relationship within himself. This is, you know, there was a time in which I used to think that the Trinity was like an unfortunate add-on or something to Christianity. I think we've all been there, right?
Oh, yeah. Yep.
We're like, well, why do we have this doctrine? It's so hard to explain at times and just doesn't seem necessary. And more and more I get into theology and philosophy, I just thank God for the Trinity. Because seriously, we wouldn't understand God the way that we do. We would have no meaningful way of talking about a God of love. I mean, the only way that we could even talk about a God of love is if God created something to love, right? And the fact is, in Christianity, God doesn't need us to know what love is. God doesn't need us to know what relationship is. He is complete in and of himself, and from himself he has created us. And in fact, the Bible tells us in Genesis that he has created us in his image. And to me, this is really meaningful. It means then that I've been created in the image of a relational God. It shouldn't surprise me then that I seek relationship. And unfortunately, in that relationship, there in the garden, that right relationship was broken by an act of disobedience, by creating a counterfeit standard, by creating a counterfeit good, a standard of relationship that does not compare with God's standard.
Right. And one thing that I really appreciated about, I remember having this one conversation with an agnostic who said, well, why did God create us that way? Why did God create us so that we have to be with him? And what kind of a God is that who gives us free choice, but if we happen to do something that he doesn't like, then he condemns us to hell for all eternity? What kind of a God is that? But I think what this fella doesn't understand is that's just the nature of who we are. That's we are just, by the very essence of who we are, we have to be with God. Just like a diesel truck can run on gasoline, right? It's just how we're made. And if you don't want to be with God and you reject him, you can do that, but there is going to be consequences, just as there is when you put gasoline into a diesel truck, which, by the way, one friend of mine apparently has done. His father was not impressed.
It doesn't end well. No,
no, not very well.
But I think this is the same challenge, though, maybe put a little bit differently, that every parent faces. Mm-hmm. You know, I think my son could come back to me and say, you know, Dad, why did you have me? Mm-hmm. Or why did you, you know, I can't really say bring me into existence, but ultimately, why'd you choose to have children? Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, we raise the same question often with God. God, why did you create me? You know, whether or not you created me in this way or not, I mean, really, I can't think of another way for God to have created you for you to even have an issue with it. Because if God didn't create you relationally, well, then you would, I don't know what kind of faculties you would even have to be upset with God.
Yeah.
So, but ultimately that we have been made by God in his image, and it's a relational image. And so we are inherently relational with God and with each other. And as you're saying, this is the way we were made. Mm-hmm. But it raises that question. Well, then why did God just create us in the beginning? Maybe just not create us at all. And again, I think my kid could ask me the same question. And the only response that I can think of is that I chose to have children because I love them. I love my son, and I desire to be in a right relationship with my son. And although I know I can't guarantee that I'll have a right relationship with my son, clearly I thought it was worth the risk, mm-hmm. or else I wouldn't have had children. And I think that we see the same thing with God, that God desires to be in a right relationship with us. Mm-hmm. And although he couldn't guarantee that, and clearly we saw from the passage I just read in Genesis that this isn't the way things worked out, mm-hmm. that corruption and brokenness did come into the world. But this was worth the risk for God. And that ultimately what we're going to see as you read the Bible is you'll see that the Bible ends the same way it began. The Bible begins in right relationship, that relationship is broken. And now we see a God that is willing to pursue us, a God that is willing to humble himself and is that willing to enter into our brokenness, our evil, into our suffering, and is willing to seek to redeem and love the lost, that he would bring us back into right relationship with himself. And that ultimately this is going to lead us to Jesus, it's going to lead us to the cross, and it's going to lead to our hope of heaven, in which we are in right relationship with God, in which things are the way they ought to be. Now, I don't think that you need to wait for death and for that relationship to begin. I think it begins right now. When we give our lives to Jesus Christ, we start a relationship with God. The beauty of it is, it's a relationship with God that does not end, in which will be ultimately fulfilled. Everything will be made right when we meet him face to face. And this ultimately then is our hope in Christianity. This is a hope then that humanizes us. Not that I meet God in my image, but that I've been made in God's image. And it's only through my relationship with God and God's very existence that I can even make sense of any of this. So back to that very first story then I said at the beginning, when somebody says to me that, like my friend's brother did, I can't believe in God because there's too much evil in the world. Mm-hmm. I just ask people that say that a simple question. What exactly do you mean by evil? And basically just begin to ask those people questions, because clearly they're hurting. Mm-hmm. They're hurting emotionally, and they're also hurting intellectually as they're trying to wrestle through these questions. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes we just need to ask them questions to start to get them to think about it. And I think that there's times in which those people, we just need to give them hugs. We need to pray for them. We need to walk with them. We need to listen to them. But I truly believe there's times that we need to just question them. Yeah. And just say, you know, have you really thought that through? What exactly do you mean by evil? Because as you begin to pull that onion apart, if you will, you begin to see that it becomes just nonsense. It's like saying, I can't believe in money because there's too much counterfeit currency in the world. And I'm like, excuse me? You know, and you start to see, if you can't believe in God's existence because there's too much evil in the world, well, you can't believe in evil either. I was talking to a lady about this just recently. Her husband died of cancer, and then shortly after that, her 13-year-old son died of cancer. Mm-hmm. So it leaves you in a tough spot. In the one sense, you're angry with God, and you want to run from God. But in the same sense, it's, where do I go? Mm-hmm. If I run from God, it means that whatever happened to my husband and son was, as Dawkins says, just blind, pitiless indifference. Mm-hmm. And why am I so upset about it? But when we see in Christianity that we don't just serve some deistic God that lives far removed, that's, you know, just enjoying the show, but a God that humbled himself and entered into our suffering, right? That we begin to see, no, God's right here with me in the midst of my trials, in the midst of my suffering, and he's walking with me. And that I'm in relationship with God, and that although I'm suffering for a little while in a world that is broken, that has been corrupted and is not the way it ought to be, that it will not always be this way. And that, as the Apostle Paul says, our focus shouldn't be on this earth. It should be in our sights on heaven and that relationship to come in which things are the way they ought to be.
Well, very good. Thank you, listeners, for joining us. The Apologetics Canada podcast has been the Ministry of Apologetics Canada. Now that the zombie culture segment is over, we're going to start talking about cults and world religions and current events, among other things. So keep your ears open for that, and we'll come back to you in a week's time.
Hey, Tom, it's Bob from the office down the hall. It's good to see you, buddy. How have you been? Things have been okay for me, except that I'm a zombie now. I really wish you'd let us in. I think I speak for all of us when I say I understand why you folks might hesitate to submit to our demand. But here's an FYI, you're all gonna die. I mean, no one's gonna eat your eyes. All we wanna do is eat your brains. We're at an impasse here. Maybe we should compromise. If you open up the door, we'll all come inside and eat your brains. I don't wanna nitpick, Tom, but is this really your plan? Spend your whole life locked inside a mall. Maybe that's okay for now, but someday you'll be out of food and guns, and you'll have to make the call. I'm not surprised to see you haven't thought it through enough. You never had the head for all that bigger picture stuff. But Tom, that's what I do, and I plan on eating you slowly.
All we wanna do is eat your brains.
We're not unreasonable. I mean, no one's gonna eat your eyes.
All we wanna do is eat your brains.
We're at an impasse here. Compromise. You open up the door, we'll all come inside and eat your brains. I'd like to help you, Tom, in any way I can. I sure appreciate the way you're working with me. I'm not a monster, Tom. Well, technically I am. I guess I got another meeting, Tom. Maybe we could wrap it up. We'll get to common ground somehow. Meanwhile, I'll report back to my colleagues who were chewing on the doors. I guess we'll table this for now. I'm glad to see you take constructive criticism well. Thank you for your time. I know we're all busy as hell. And we'll put this thing to bed when I bash your head open.
All we wanna do is eat your brains.
We're not unreasonable. I mean, no one's gonna eat your eyes.
All we wanna do is eat your brains.
We're at an impasse here. Maybe we should compromise. Open up the doors, we'll all come inside.